on air, online, on digital, and the ABC Listen app. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
And today, tougher biosecurity rules for flowers imported into Tasmania from Victoria.
That's going to extend the lead time as well. They're going to be even older by the time they get to point A, then they're fumigated or dipped or whatever, and then they go to the next point. It's just going to make it even longer.
And the oyster farmer helping fire victims on the east coast.
We were actually on standby with our oyster barges just in case we needed to help in the transport of people from the beach at Stiglitz.
Yeah, the oyster farmer helping out fire victims at Stiglitz, and as you heard in the news there, that fire has been contained, which is good news today. G'day, Tony Briscoe with you on this Thursday. Well, we also look at stronger biosecurity controls for flowers imported into the state from Victoria, and that's due to the detection of the tomato potato psyllid in Melbourne, a pest that is not currently in Tasmania. And we don't want it, thank you. Also today, a flower farm in the south that's blooming at the moment with lavenders, and their farming couple are about to open up the farm for visitors to pick their own in time for Christmas. And we also look at liability for farmers if a fire starts on the land and spreads to adjacent properties that may contain renewables. What's the role of the insurance company and the protection for farmers? We'll check the latest on the weather in around about 10 minutes from now and take your thoughts via that text line. 0438 922 936 is that number. 0438 922 936. First up, Tasmanian florists are among a number of industries caught up in tougher biosecurity rules that will impact fresh fruit and veg and plant material imported from Victoria. Tomato potato psyllid was recently detected in Melbourne, a pest we don't have here. Larissa Smith caught up with Launceston florist Meg Lee to find out what the new restrictions will involve.
We currently buy in maybe 25 to 30% of our flowers into our shop from Victoria. The issue at the minute is with the finding of the tomato potato psyllid in Melbourne has certainly thrown a spanner in the works in the lead up to Christmas. We're currently though in a 2-week grace period, so that will get us through to Christmas with what we can import. So our already placed orders are fine to come in, so that's great. After that, we have to work with biosecurity to actually find out what we're going to do going forward and whether there is going to be a permit system or whether flowers have got to be fumigated or dipped in certain chemicals. I expect there'll be lots of paperwork and, of course, an extra cost to the wholesaler, the producer, the florist, and, of course, the end consumer.
And that would concern you because at this point you don't want to be passing that on to your customers.
Oh. Exactly. At this stage, we sort of, by the time we pay for everything else, you don't want to, but if push comes to shove, it just adds an extra level of complexity to the situation.
So what sorts of flowers would you bring in and why do you need to bring them in? You can't source them in Tassie?
The main one is my concern at the minute is the Christmas lilies, Lilium longiflorum, because no one in Tasmania actually grows them. We're very lucky here that we've got great flower growers who grow, and we have a fantastic lily grower. But Lilium longiflorum, i.e. November lily, Easter lily, is a special lily which people only want at Christmas. It's only grown in one time of year, and no one, if you're not set up for it probably 12 months ago, we're not going to get it in the next week. So Christmas lilies are a situation that we sort of can't get around. The other thing that's my main concern is I buy a lot of ferns in, like the leather fern and umbrella fern and things.
For a filler.
Yeah, for a filler and a greenery and such, that's what actually, no one grows that here. Other foliages we're pretty lucky for. We can source local beech, oak and gum. We have to source locally anyway because we're not allowed to bring any foliage in that belong to the family Myrtaceae, which is the eucalyptus family. So we've already had to source locally grown gum foliages.
So if flowers or foliage are treated potentially with methyl bromide, what does that do to the life of that material?
I don't think it's a great situation in the fact that it will help, particularly delicate flowers. If you were to bring in Phalaenopsis orchids or something for a wedding, which is a very delicate, soft flower, I don't think it's going to be great. They already are meant to be treated coming into, because Phalaenopsis orchids are predominantly brought into Australia as they are only grown overseas. So they've probably already been treated with methyl bromide once, which means they're probably going to be treated with them again. It's either, and if they don't do that, they may be dipping the flowers in chemicals and things, which then means you're going to have wet petals, and it's just a whole... Some flowers are quite hardy and firm and will be fine, particularly the foliages, like the leather leaf and all that. If that was to be dipped or something, shake her off, off you go. But the delicate flowers, particularly when there's lots of petals together, you're asking for botrytis to breed and all sorts of things because it's so dense and thick.
For a wedding, a lot of lead time goes into preparing those flowers.
Exactly. And that's going to extend the lead time as well. They're going to be even older by the time they get to point A, then they're fumigated or dipped or whatever, and then they go to the next point. It's just going to make it even longer.
Are you thinking you might have to shift suppliers in Victoria depending on who decides to go ahead with accreditation, spending extra money on treatments to send to Tasmania?
We, as one shop, are pretty lucky. We probably only get, as I said, 25% in from Victoria, but other shops, and particularly other wholesalers in the state, they'd probably get up to 80% in from interstate. We're lucky in that we have good relationships with the local growers, so it's going to be a bit of a situation for a lot of people. But people also have to remember, we don't have exemptions at this point. We have a grace period. This may not be over yet.
The next big event you're preparing for is Valentine's Day.
Yes, but hopefully everyone just wants to buy red roses that we grow ourselves, so let's just go with that, shall we? Foliages might be interesting, but by that stage, gum's out of new growth, so we could source that. If it continues for the 6 months they're proposing initially, Mother's Day could be interesting. It's just going to be fun and games. We're just going to have to play it by ear, really.
How can you make this arrangement work? Because Victoria's obviously got an arrangement with Queensland.
The best scenario would be is that we bring in the same situation that Queensland has, in the fact that the grower who supplies the wholesaler in Victoria sends through accreditation that they're clear of the TPP, and then that accreditation is then forwarded to Biosecurity TAS, so then we can continue to get it through without being fumigated, dipped, irradiated. It would be extremely detrimental to our potato industry, tomato industry. Also, if we were to get it in, it's the ongoing effect. All these biosecurity issues have ongoing effects to other industries, which people don't seem to... It's the freight companies. It's everyone's affected. It's not just the potato grower, and it's not just the end consumer or the florist. It's all the other people who... The delivery man who delivers the flowers. We all pay. So we need to keep these things out.
It's Meg Lee from the Tamar Valley Rose Shop talking to Larissa Smith about tougher biosecurity rules for flowers coming to Tasmania from Victoria. In a letter to affected businesses, Biosecurity Tasmania says its new import requirements will be regulated via a group permit, which is available on its website. And we've asked Biosecurity Tasmania to explain what these changes to trade arrangements with Victoria will look like. Its Chief Plant Protection Officer will be on the program early next week to clarify. Continuing with flowers, in the south of the state, a farming family are busy with expanding their fairly new lavender farm at Mountain River. Christoph and Marcel Backes have converted a greenfield site into the lavender farm, and they're about to welcome visitors to the farm to pick their own flowers.
We run a lavender farm. It's a small-scale lavender farm, and it used to be just when we bought the property in 2021, part of a subdivision of one of the original inhabitants of Mountain River, Rex Oates. And it used to be an apple orchard back in, I think, in the middle 1900s. And they did some spuds after that. And the last couple of years before we bought the property, it was just being used for hay and just pasture, improved pasture.
So what was the journey that brought you to Mountain River?
I'm a pilot by trade. And we used to be based out of Darwin. And then an opportunity came up to locate to Tasmania, which we then took quite gladly. And my wife and I realized that, you know, you could still have a rural lifestyle in Tasmania and still be within sort of driving range of the airport or even the city. And she came from a merino farm background in South Africa. Yeah, we spent a couple of years looking around and eventually found this block, which was perfect for what we wanted to do. We wanted to give the kids our kids a similar lifestyle that they had. And after doing quite a bit of research on different sort of crops and different things we could do We decided on lavender because of the, you know, we've got about 16 acres and sort of lavender would be the perfect fit for it. She used to have a great-grandmother that used to always use this lavender perfume. And over the years, her mom, my wife's mom, used to plant lavender everywhere she went to remind her of that scent. So there's a bit of a history with the lavender running through her family. And so then in 2021, we planted out about 400 lavender plants as a trial, with seven different varieties. And then we chose two of those that that worked really well here, two angustifolias, which is the French lavender, the really high quality oil producing lavender. Yeah, so we decided to plant 4,500 of the two, what part of the block. And we had our first decent harvest at the end of 2022-23. And then decided to plant another 4,000 about a year ago. And at this stage, we're just about to start launching products and the oil that we've made as well.
So the land is pretty good for lavender, you've found.
Yes, we were not quite sure exactly how well they would do, because traditionally lavender sort of grows in more alkaline, you know, Mediterranean type of soils, rocky soils, sandy soils. So we were a bit unsure of how they would go, but we really concentrate on growing organically. So we figured if we could improve, you know, the soil health, we wouldn't have to try and give everything to the plants that we think that they need. So we went down the whole rabbit hole of regenerative farming. Our neighbors do the same sort of thing. And we sort of gambled that, you know, if we could improve the soil, and increase the biodiversity in the soil itself, the lavender will then be able to extract what it required. And we found that it's been, you know, it's done really well. We've had some great yield, and we actually were awarded a certificate of merit for our blend of oil by the Australian Lavender Growers Association this year, which was the, you know, every 2 years they have this oil competition.
What sort of buildings were on the property when you took it over?
When we bought the property, there weren't any buildings at all. It was literally just a grass paddock. So, it's a beautiful north-facing paddock overlooking Sleeping Beauty, you know, Collins Bonnet in the background here. So it's an absolutely fabulous amphitheater of, you know, trees and hills around us. And we sat on top of the highest point of the property, on a little hill, and we just thought, you know, this was it. So yes, since then we've built a shed ourselves. The first thing we did was refence the whole property because it was quite a dilapidated old fence, and we needed to keep the wallabies and things like that out to try and rabbits to try and protect the lavender and the crops. So yes, we 400 meter driveway that we had to get built. We redid all the fencing. We did an owner builder shed, so we built a big 200 square meter shed ourselves. We also had to sink a bore as we were cut off from the river, as this used to be part of a bigger apple orchard. It was subdivided by, you know, the grandkids over time. So our little block didn't have direct access to any water. So, yeah, we had to get a borehole sunk, which was really good. We've been blessed with beautiful water, plenty of water as well. So we've, you know, installed irrigation to all the lavender, which they don't really need in the longer term, but in the first 2 years, it's quite good for them to be irrigated in the summer. And we just recently finished our house as well. We moved in at the end of July, so we're actually on the block now as well, which has been fantastic. So, yes.
Okay, and from what I have here at home with a few lavender plants, I know the bees love them.
Yes, we had plenty of bees initially, and about a year and a half ago, we put up three beehives as well. So we've been, we extracted last summer, we extracted our first honey. When we harvest the lavender, we actually have the kids with brooms in front of our, we've got a little handheld or hand pushed harvester machine. And it's basically like a hedge trimmer on wheels, and it straddles over the lavender. And so we get the girls to sort of walk in front of us with brooms and to remove the bees as we harvest. We don't want them to end up in the still. Plenty of bees and beautiful honey. Yeah. What we've got planned at this stage, we will be opening up to appointments only this season. So from about mid-December, we're going to be looking at pick-your-own days. So we'll have people come in. We'll have some picnic tables set up, some tents, and We are working on getting some local ice cream made for us as well with our lavender. And yes, we'll get some people in and they can come and have a stroll through the lavender, to, take some photos, pick their own lavender as well, and, you know, take bunches home with them. And yes, we've just started prepping, well, a couple of weeks ago, we started prepping for another 7,000 lavender we'll plant out in autumn. So we just put a cover crop out on that.
It's Christoph Backers, who runs a lavender farm with his wife Marcel at Mountain River in the south of the state, with plans to almost double the plantings of the flowers on the fairly new farm. Today would be a great day to be out on the lavender farm. Let's check the weather with Ellie Matthews from the Bureau. G'day, Ellie.
Afternoon, Tony. How are you?
Yeah, good. Be a good day to be out in the cricket pitch for you, wouldn't it?
It certainly would be. The sun's pretty well out right the way across the state. The only places that have got a little bit of cloud is really just over the Bass Strait Islands and maybe a little bit about the northeast. So otherwise, the sun is out. We did have a bit of a cool start. Again, this morning, we did see some minimum temperatures, particularly about the inland locations, getting down nearing that 1 or 2 degree mark. So Tunnock got down to 1 this morning. Cressy got down to 2. Fingal got down to 3. And even plenty of other locations down below that 5 degree mark. So that is sort of well below average for this time of year. And that's all thanks to these clear skies that are brought by the high pressure ridge that's over the state at the moment. So it is bringing relatively settled weather conditions. We are seeing some onshore sea breezes across most coasts, but otherwise generally light winds across the state today. We do expect these to continue for today and into tomorrow before this high does move out into the Tasman Sea, and it will shift the winds more to a north-northeasterly direction later on Friday. So we will start to see some increasing moderate northerly winds across parts of the state, maybe more fresh to locally strong about some parts of the far northwest coast, or potentially about the lower east coast during tomorrow. So it's into the weekend, though, that we do start to see a shift in these what have been relatively settled weather conditions over the past few days. So by Saturday, we will start to see a trough and front approaching the state and moving over, which will bring isolated storms across parts of the north and east in particular during Saturday. Now, with those storms, in terms of rainfall, there could be sort of less than 5 millimetres or so with those. So it could be little rainfall expected with those. But it's on Sunday that we do see the main change coming through with quite a strong cold front that will bring quite some fresh west to northwesterly winds, as well as showers across much of the state. They'll be more frequent about the west, and we could be seeing sort of 20 to 40 millimetres into parts of the west on Sunday, but elsewhere about the state, generally less than 5 millimetres with showers during Sunday. And we do see these gusty winds continuing into Monday as well. So there, whilst the warm, settled weather is here for at least today and into tomorrow, it is changing over the weekend, Tony.
What sort of temperatures have we at the moment?
Yeah, at the moment we have seen some maximum temperatures so far reaching up to around 20 degrees for some locations. So Launceston's actually currently being the state's maximum. So it got up to 21 degrees just merely minutes ago. But otherwise, some inland locations about the Upper Derwent and Southern Midlands have reached up to 20 degrees. But otherwise, high teens for most locations about the state, just a little bit cooler about the coast.
And warnings, Ellie.
Warnings, there's none for today, but into tomorrow we do see a strong wind warning for eastern coastal waters from the northern tip of Flinders Island to southeast Cape, as well as for the far northwest coast tomorrow, which does bring me to what is happening on the coastal waters. So at the moment, we're generally starting to see winds becoming more variable below 15 knots with some inshore afternoon sea breezes. And into tomorrow, we will start to see these winds tending more east to northeasterly of 15 to 25 knots about the north and east. We will see those winds reaching up to 30 knots about the far northwest and lower east coast in particular. The winds will be variable about the west and south with afternoon sea breezes expected during tomorrow there. with the swells in the west and south. We've got a west to southwesterly of 2 to 3 metres, which into tomorrow will start to decay back to 1.5 to 2.5 metres. Through Bass Strait today, we've got a westerly to 1 metre, expecting that to decay to below 1 metre tomorrow, whilst in the east, a southerly below 1 metre will continue, Tony.
And the wave riders.
Yes, wave riders. So out in the west at the moment, Cape Sorel is currently a significant wave height of 3.3 metres from a westerly direction, reaching up to a maximum of about 5.2 metres, whilst out in the east, Maria Island is just under a metre as a significant wave height from a southerly direction.
Thank you, Ellie. You go enjoy that sun.
That I will. Thanks, Tony.
Good on you. Ellie Matthews from the Bureau there with the latest information for you. Coming up in just a moment, we'll look at the record amount of beef being exported.
On a Thursday, the fridge is empty. What will you cook? Join me to learn a new easy recipe. I'll even send you the shopping list.
Joel Reinberger back this afternoon from 1:30 on 936 ABC Radio Hobart.
Coast to coast, this is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Now, the year's almost over, but already Australia has broken the record for the most amount of beef exported in a calendar year. Australia has sold nearly 1.4 million tonnes of beef to customers around the world between January and November, which is up 15% year on year. Tim Jackson from Meat and Livestock Australia says Australia's been producing record amounts of beef this year, and overseas demand has been snapping it up, especially the US.
US production has been falling this year. And so that's pushed up their import demand, and that's had an effect on beef markets globally. So their exports have gone down, and their imports have gone up. That's meant that the United States so far, like in this year so far, has been the biggest single market so far. Exports are up 17% year on year from last year to just over 400,000 tons. But it's also meant, because there's, you know, relatively less US beef for export, that there's a little bit more space for Australian beef in the market. So the US has been quite important in that sort of effect.
The 10% tariff introduced earlier in the year, which is now gone in the end. Did that 10% tariff mean anything?
Oh, it's still really difficult to say, because those supply dynamics are really powerful. And we've seen in the US really robust demand for beef. We've seen, you know, even with pretty high pricing of American cattle and American beef, we've seen American beef demand at really, really high levels. And so in the context where, you know, their domestic production is short and demand is really high, those kind of dynamics have ended up being really important in terms of how the trades went. And so it's really hard to then break the tariff effect out from that.
If American consumers had balked at higher prices, it could have been a very different story, but they were willing to pay, and hence the beef kept flowing.
Yeah, they were willing to pay, and demand in the US has been really good. And, you know, Australia exports to in terms of red meat generally over 100 markets. So while the US has been really important, it's not the only market. And we've seen quite strong demand right across our major markets. And we've seen strong growth in a lot of the smaller, kind of more emerging markets. So it's been, yeah, big volumes across the board, really.
Exports into Greater China up 37%. Is that right?
Yep, that's right. So up 37%. And again, the US is an exporter into China. And so we've been able to build some market share over them, both because of the US supply shortage and because of some kind of trade hiccups that have been going on there. But then,
well, you say hiccups, but it almost looks like a ban, really. They have not been able to export any beef to China this year.
Yeah. Oh, look, we'll see how it goes with that. But I mean, the fact is that we've seen, you know, strong demand for beef, like Australian beef in China. And again, there are those kind of supply demand dynamics, those big picture macro sorts of things. But then also, like, Australia's reputation in market is really strong.
If you're tuning in, this is the Country Hour, and we're talking beef with Tim Jackson from Meat and Livestock Australia. So Australia is producing record amounts of beef. It's exporting record amounts of beef. And the slaughter numbers this year, Tim, have been massive. Is Australia chewing into its own herd?
So we're on the last projections that we did, which came out in September, we forecast a kind of slight, like a marginal herd destocking. So the size of the herd coming down a little bit, but not particularly substantially. We've seen supply being, you know, really quite strong this year. Slaughter numbers have been, like you say, really quite high. And we put that down to, you know, in some parts of the country, pretty good seasons now for up to, you know, 5 years in a row. And in other parts, obviously, there's been like conditions have been pretty different. But on the whole, because we had that really strong herd rebuild right around the country in, you know, 2020, 21, 22, and then kind of since then, we've actually not had bad seasons. We haven't had that big sell-off and that big liquidation. We're now saying that this kind of big mature herd, which is able to turn off really substantial volumes, like really big numbers of cattle, yeah, which is then flowing through to big numbers of production. And I think the other thing to note here, because we're talking about exports, which is ultimately about tons of beef, is that carcass weights have remained really high. And that's contributed then to the high production export numbers.
Yes, as in it's actually not a record amount of cattle that have been killed this year, but what has been killed has produced a record amount of beef.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And so, and you know, there are a lot of different reasons for that because, you know, on the one hand, like we've seen, you know, a bit of a change in the genetic profile of the herd, changes in management practices on farm, all those sorts of things which are contributing to heavier carcass weights which flow into production. And of course, you have to look at, you know, the feedlot sector. And so you can kind of see that in the sense that, you know, feedlot capacity has been rising, national capacity has been rising, turnoff has been rising, and that contributes to the carcass weights. But then that also means that grain-fed exports have been really strong this year.
Yeah, I've got here grain-fed beef exports, again, a record and an increase of 19% year on year. And if that demand stays where it is, prices should, for cattle producers in Australia, go in one way. They should.
Yeah,
markets can do funny things.
Yeah, there's so much. There's so much that goes into it. But just to pick, you know, there's the exchange rate and the input costs and there's the consumer demand. There's so much that goes into price, which is why we don't do the forecasting.
We can agree there's positive signs. How's that sound?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Tim Jackson, thanks for your time on the Country Hour.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, Tim Jackson, Global Supply Analyst for Meat and Livestock Australia, speaking there to Matt Brown about beef exports. Still to come on today's edition of the Country Hour, an East Coast oyster grower helping out in the fire efforts. And farm insurance issues for fire spreads from your property. First up, though, the news headlines with Guy Stainer.
Good afternoon, Tony. In ABC News, a bushfire at St Helens on Tasmania's east coast has now been contained, with the fire service taking advantage of calmer weather today. But watch and act alerts remain in place for the Stiglitz, Parnella, Parkside, Diana's Basin and Flagstaff Hill areas. The federal government has committed more than $200 million to enable the icebreaker RSV Nuyina to carry out more research voyages. Tasmania's Southern Midlands Council has approved plans for a new youth justice facility at Pontville in the state's south. The facility will eventually replace the controversial Ashley Youth Detention Centre in the north. Venezuela's government is accusing the US of theft and international piracy after having an oil tanker seized off its coast. And details of a Canberra burglary, which netted $10 million worth of luxury items, have been released. Four French nationals are in custody. The items stolen included a $5 million watch. More news at 1.
Hi, I'm Kylie Baxter, and you know why I love the ABC Giving Tree? When times are tough, the Giving Tree reminds us to look out for each other.
Text Giving Tree to 0438 922 936.
Keeping you updated every day. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Oyster barges have been on standby as fires at Stiglitz near St Helens on Tuesday afternoon quickly escalated to emergency warning levels, and with residents evacuated, two houses lost, the situation was changing quickly over the 24 hours and more. Craig Lockwood is an oyster farmer in St Helens, and while his operation was on the other side of the bay, he was on standby waiting to help out. Fiona Breen discussed yesterday afternoon how quickly the situation worsened with Craig.
We observed we're actually working out on our long lines in the middle of the bay, and we observed the smoke billowing into the air. I'm not certain what time of the afternoon it was, but it takes us 20 minutes to leave that area and get back into our shore base in St Helens. And when we reached that, I immediately tried to contact some of the fireys I knew to see if they were aware of it. Of course, I couldn't get those people on the phone, and now I'm very well aware why, and that was because they were down there fighting the fire then. Within probably 2 hours, it was right up into the back of the aerodrome area and very fierce.
Now, you were on the water working. Did the wind really whip up?
Yes, it did. It's been quite strange, the weather this year, in that when we're out on the water, we'll get strong gusts and fairly strong winds through part of the day, and then all of a sudden it will drop out and go calm, and then later on you'll get these breezes that keep lifting up and freshening as we go through the day.
Well, let's hope that the danger is over, but it's been dry up there in the St Helens area?
Yeah, it's been very dry throughout this year. The underground aquifers have been not too healthy from the level of water in them, and this ongoing wind continually dries out these acid sulfate soils. So it's very, very likely that grass fires would go like this fire went yesterday as well.
And you're in oyster farming, so not land farming, but does the dry affect you? Do these sorts of conditions affect you?
Yeah, well, we rely on a lot of food resource from the catchment. Temperature control, of course, is in the arms of our catchments, and that determines the amount of growth we get in terms of algae and other food inputs that come in from that system. So, it does have some impact. There's no doubt about that.
And how are the oysters going at the moment?
They've been going along reasonably well, considering demand has diminished quite a bit. So the demand we would have in most years would be double what we're currently seeing. So we're able to cope with that in terms of where the season is and the productivity of the water, whereas if it had have been like it was in numerous years previous, we would be struggling to service the market.
And what's the market telling you, or what are sellers telling you about the market? Why is it down?
Well, it's been a determination of the government to stop spending by the public in certain areas. And, of course, oysters are one of those areas where we always see impact when these imposts are the higher interest rates, etc., and those other factors that control spending are in place. So we've naturally felt the adversity of that.
People are tightening their belts.
They definitely are.
It's Craig Lockwood, the owner of Lease 65 Oysters at St Helens, talking to Fiona Breen about the bushfires and the oyster business at the moment. Don't forget to stay in touch via text line 0438 922 936. Martin has done that, sent me a lovely text message. Thanks, Martin. I'm glad you're enjoying the program, and hope you have a lovely Christmas and a wonderful new year. Now, are you liable if a fire starts on your property and spreads to an adjacent renewable facility and destroys it? That's a question farmers have been asking for a while now, and one Australian Energy Infrastructure Commissioner, Tony Marr, has been working to address. He's working with insurers and renewable companies to develop a policy that protects landowners. He says landowners need certainty around liability.
Yeah, look, we've been hearing a lot about concerns and queries about public liability insurance from landholders right across the country. So what we did is we got the insurance sector together, the energy sector together, and just came up with a pathway forward to make sure that people's concerns around public liability insurance and any expectations of changes to that because of the neighbouring properties having renewable energy infrastructure can be addressed in a nationally consistent way where the landholder isn't liable for, you know, public liability beyond what they've got in their existing farm pack or household insurance.
Okay, so for example, it might be someone harvesting in a paddock next door to a solar or wind facility. A fire starts, fire sweeps through that facility, and that farmer being concerned that they'd be liable?
That's right. That's a good example. And, you know, on the basis that it's accidental and not negligent or deliberate and things like that, then, you know, that the pathway we're going and the agreement and the commitment we've got from the energy sector companies and insurance sector is that that particular scenario, the landholder is not liable for any damage caused. And their policies aren't impacted or premiums aren't impacted. It's just a recognition that the energy sector is responsible for that asset, not the landholder.
So what do you actually want to happen? Does this need to be in writing, legally binding, that neighbours will not be liable?
Yes, yeah, it does. That's what we're wanting to do. So we had an initial conversation. Been talking for a couple of months now with Clean Energy Council and Insurance Council of Australia and their members, but certainly what we're aiming to come up with is a clause in the contracts, you know, premiums or policies, commitments and, you know, watertight, legally binding commitments to give people confidence, landholders confidence that their existing public liability insurance doesn't have to be amended or revised and is adequate for their current purposes if they are close to renewable energy infrastructure. They don't have to worry about additional public liability insurance, is basically what we're saying.
And the renewables companies you've spoken to, are they supportive of this?
Yeah, very. Yeah, there's one company that's already doing it. There's another a lot of companies that are aware of it. But what we wanted to do is get a whole of industry approach with this. Again, we've had really good cooperation with the Clean Energy Council. They know it's an issue they need to address. The Insurance Council was likewise aware of it. And there's some details to work through, but the announcement this week is really that we've got that agreement to address this issue and make sure that there's no negative impact on landholders.
It's a long list, isn't it, the list of concerns of those who might end up being neighbours of some of these facilities?
Yeah, it is. I mean, and the obvious scenario that you outlined, that's predominantly where we started. But there are, in any sort of risk strategy, there's plenty of risks that you need to be aware of. But that immediate sort of fire risk and it, you know, flowing through a valley, which we know can go really quickly and damage lots of properties and assets and things, was one of the catalysts for this discussion. So, look, it's going in the right direction. I'm really pleased that we've got agreement from insurance companies and energy companies to make sure that this isn't an issue going forward for landholders.
On the flip side to what we've been talking about, I know a lot of people have concerns about renewables facilities, battery sites or transmission lines starting fires. What's in place to protect those people and mitigate those concerns?
Yeah, look, a couple of things. That's certainly a concern that I hear about too as I travel around, and it absolutely needs to be addressed. I mean, the energy companies need to provide adequate information and confidence and demonstration that they are taking account of the fire risks. So that's absolutely fundamental. In relation to the insurance aspects of, you know, if there's an incident from a battery or from a turbine, starting a fire, then the absolute expectation is that the energy companies have, you know, the appropriate levels of insurance to cover all of that. And my understanding is that they do, but, that should be part of the ongoing discussion with energy companies and the community to make sure that there's complete confidence in that regard.
That was Australian Energy Infrastructure Commissioner Tony Maher speaking with Angus Verley about fire breaking out on your property and heading next door and destroying some renewable infrastructure. Well, Australia's almond industry is expected to further expand its planting area by up to 10,000 hectares in the next 5 years as global demand for the nut continues to rise. Rubber research analyst Pia Piggott says new planting areas are mainly in New South Wales, while orchards are also being replanted in Victoria and South Australia. She explains why export opportunities for Australian almonds are expected to remain strong.
So Australia currently has about 66,000 hectares of almond plantings, and about 16% of that is over the next 5 years going to reach about 25 years of age. And so we're going to see most of that requiring replanting. So that's about 16% of the existing orchard. On top of that, if we go even further, looking about from 2006 to 2010, there are another additional 13,000 hectares of plantings then. And they're also over the next 5 years going to reach that later stage of maturity. And we also might see further replantings from those orchards. So definitely above 16% of the existing orchard is going to need replanting in the next 5 years. And we could see that reach upwards of 20 to 25% of our total orchard area.
The outlook also shows expansion will be into new areas and new regions. Where are those new regions that the almond industry is expanding into?
There's been a lot of peaks and troughs in plantings of almonds in Australia. And in 2024, we saw a bit of an uptick in plantings to the surprise of many. But really what we're expecting to see is quite a moderate expansion continuing around 10,000 hectares by 2030, which is pretty small in comparison to what we've seen, say, prior to the last really a large wave of plantings in Australia. And a lot of what we've seen is still in the southern Murray-Darling Basin, but also moving above the choke. We've seen a lot of growth in orchard developments above the choke, a lot more in, say, New South Wales regions as well. So we're continuing to see that happen, and those are likely to be where the new plantings will come from.
Are there any other new areas in Victoria and South Australia where the industry is expanding?
Our understanding is that for South Australia and Victoria, we're pretty much at capacity, but we could definitely see some further expansion in those regions, particularly away from, say, wine grapes or grapes and other industries if they're experiencing lower profitability. But water is definitely going to be a key consideration for expansion into new areas, and that will definitely be a limiting factor for expansion across Australia.
You've mentioned their water. Given these new expansions, is there enough water availability in the Murray-Darling Basin for these expansions to happen?
At the moment, we're seeing that, at least this year, the storage levels in the southern Murray-Darling Basin are about 60%, and that's only up 6 percentage points from the start of June 2025. So it's the lowest October storage levels since 2020, and that's really been due to below average daily inflows. So we've seen temporary water prices increase a little bit this year because of those lower storage levels. There's been a lot of work done on understanding in regards to water and how much, if there's going to be, particularly in a drought situation, if there's going to be enough water. And that's definitely a key consideration for almond growers. And that's why it's really important to have a water strategy in place and making sure that you have enough water and have a strategy for periods where there is plenty of water as well as when there isn't.
And water is one challenge. Then another is pollination services. With the arrival of Varroa mite a couple of years ago in New South Wales and it now spreading across states, how will the industry ensure there is enough pollination services available?
Yeah, that's definitely been a challenge for the past couple of years. And over the next few years as well, it will definitely remain a challenge. One interesting thing we've seen is that self-fertile varieties of almond trees have really risen in popularity. So from 2019 to 2023, only about 13% of new plantings were self-fertile varieties. And in 2024, that was actually 52%. Of planting. So we've seen that more recently, self-fertile varieties are definitely the choice for orchard developments. And that should hopefully be positive in reducing the pressure and demand for some pollination services. However, even in self-fertile varieties, pollination services are really beneficial. So that's one aspect of it, but the definitely like costs and trying to acquire bees remains a challenge.
What opportunities are there for Australia's almond industry to further expand on export markets?
So globally, Australia is the second largest almond producer in the world. And what's really interesting about that is while it's the second largest, we're contributing less than 10% of global production because California remains the dominant supplier in the industry. And what we're expecting to see is that California's production is going to peak next year and then flatline because they've actually had a lot of removals of trees and their standing acreage is pretty flatlined now. And so because of that, we expect that Australia will actually be able to grow its market share in the global space. And what we've seen most recently is that China has been a really large market for Australian almonds, particularly this year, thanks to the tariffs with the US and China, retaliatory tariffs that China put on US almonds that went up to 160% for a very short period, led to quite a significant shift in China's demand for almonds to come from Australia. So before 2025, China roughly imported about 50-50 almond product from the US and Australia, but that's definitely shifted in Australia's favour this year. And that's been really positive for Australian almond producers, improving their revenues because the tariffs have supported a premium on Australian almonds. And following that, we've also seen markets grow in other regions. So we've seen India grow at about 23% last year and outside of China averaging about 8% growth in exports year on year. So we are seeing a lot of growth in exports from around the world, but it's largely been in China and in India.
Rabo research analyst Pia Pickett speaking to Jess Schremer about the expansion of the almond crop in the next 5 years, some 10,000 extra hectares to be planted as global demand for the nut continues to rise. In a moment, testing of imported honey.
Helen Shield from Evenings with the ABC Giving Tree. A donation of $20 can help to feed someone a special Christmas lunch.
Text Giving Tree to 0438 922 936. We'll reply with a link for you to give.
The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Australian beekeepers have funded an investigation into the authenticity of imported honey on supermarket shelves, with early results showing some imports are not pure. The industry tested 30 products and some showed signs of adulteration. Chair of the Australian Honeybee Industry Council, John Lockwood, says the industry is on a mission to modernise Australia's testing standards.
We were lucky enough, a few good beekeepers donated enough money and we did a bit of a survey off the shelf and got some honey off the supermarkets and got it tested in Germany.
And John, do you have results that you can share on what that testing found?
Specific brands. We're not after a witch hunt here. We're just trying to paint a bit of a picture of what's happening with the honey coming into Australia to give us a bit more of an understanding. So what we've done, we've taken that data to the federal government or DAF, and we're working with DAF very closely to demonstrate what we're finding with the imported honey coming into Australia.
Can you give us, I guess, a sense of the amount of tests that you ran and the amount that showed that the honey was adulterated in some form?
Yeah, we only did a broad sweep. We only did about 30, and we found a few honeys that had been pre-packed before they were imported into Australia that showed that they were adulterated. So our end goal here is to show DAF that perhaps some of this honey is slipping through the cracks with their current testing protocol, and that testing protocol needs to be examined and brought up to the modern day era.
From what you're saying, the testing that is done with DAF and the testing that the industry paid for done in Germany, they're quite different by the sound of things. So what are those differences?
Yeah, that's correct. So the current testing protocol to import honey is very, very outdated. It's simply what's called a C4 test, moisture and reducing sugars. So it's not very comprehensive whatsoever. As opposed to some more modern techniques that can be used around the world, which we'd love to see adopted here in Australia.
When we say adulterated honey,
what can be in it?
Quite often. So this isn't just an Australian problem. This is a massive problem internationally. Honey is one of the most adulterated products globally, and it's often adulterated with sugar syrups or rice syrups, particularly coming out of Asian countries.
And is the problem with the testing that's currently done, the Australian standard testing, that it doesn't pick up some of the products that it can be mixed with, say rice syrup?
Yeah, that is a problem, which again isn't particularly Australia's problem solely. It's a very grey area internationally how to detect a pure honey.
Is there a level of adulteration that is acceptable with honey coming in, like a level of, I don't know, sugar in the product that is allowed?
No, absolutely not. So any honey should only be produced from the bee. That's what we really need to advocate for. And we're really just trying to give our Australian beekeepers a level playing field to operate in the market.
And what's it like, John? You're a beekeeper yourself. You're working hard. You're producing this beautiful product and you're competing with an imported product, and that imported product is potentially not pure honey. How does all that stack?
Oh, well, yeah, I think I speak for most beekeepers here. It's not very, doesn't sit very well with the guy on the ground. We'd like to see, yeah, a fair playing field, and Australian honey is the best honey in the world. It's very pure. We produce it from pristine landscapes, and, we need to get our best value for that product.
And for the consumer, how do they ensure that what they're eating is actually honey?
The consumer, the biggest thing that they can do for the Australian industry and ensure that their honey is pure is to ensure that it's 100% Australian honey. So look on the back of the label, 100% Australian, and it's not mixed with any imported honey whatsoever. And that would give the Australian beekeeper a great advantage. You know, we need to bring back into our minds why it's so important to have bees, and that's pollination. So one out of every three mouthfuls of food we consume is directly impacted by honeybees pollinating that crop. So by buying Australian honey, we're really supporting the beekeeper and therefore food security.
Yeah, the chair of the Australian Honey Bee Industry Council, John Lockwood, talking to Joe Prendergast about the testing of imported honey brands. They tested 30 products and some showed signs of adulteration. Tewkesbury Dave says, buy local and you'll get the best honey. Yeah, good on you, Dave. Have a happy Christmas too to you. I'll put a podcast of today's program up for you. We'll have another country hour after midday tomorrow with the livestock markets and Richard Bailey, big store cattle sale today.